I think this may be the happiest we're going to be this morning. Right now, this is it. We're going to start off. I just don't want to set your anticipations, but this may be the height of the giddiness in this room. But good morning, everyone. Welcome. Terrific music, and we will. You can find out more about it on the playlist posted. Pierre Dubost, I believe, D-U-B-O-S-T. I think that's how that's pronounced, Pierre Dubost. And we'll be hearing that this morning. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program for this ninth day of April. It is 12 minutes past 9 o'clock. A lot to talk about with a wonderful group of panelists. And we welcome you as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we welcome you. And we'll get to the panel letters in just a little bit. We ask that you make them short and to the point. We've been getting a lot lately, and we want to make sure that we can get to as many as possible. It doesn't take that long for you to convey your anger. All right. Let us go to the introductory phase of the program, where we welcome our wonderful group here. Kathy Sheehan is with us, the mayor of the city of Albany. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
I am good. The sun is shining. It's a little chilly. And we're doing a groundbreaking today at the Tivoli Preserve. We're going to be constructing yet another trail out there. And so I'm very excited. We're going to apparently bless a tree, and there'll be animals, and it'll be a wonderful experience.
So it's very spring and very upbeat. That's very nice. And you're with us till about 9:30, 10 o'clock?
No, I can stay. We move some things around
okay,
for
good.
You, Joe.
Excellent.
For you.
Well,
yes.
Thank you very much. I feel special. That's good. I also want to thank Anna Markowitz for being here. Brand new title, and we couldn't be more thrilled. Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead. And Anna, it's wonderful to have you here. I guess you mean power supplies, but it would just be cool if it was just I'm in charge of power.
Yes. Some of my friends are like, "Do you run a power company now? What happened?" No, we advocate for affordable and cleaner energy at the state level. We are plaintiffs in rate cases against Central Hudson, so we took part in some of the utility debt cancellation that has happened in the past, which resulted in millions of dollars going back into the pockets of rate payers. So, fighting the good fight. And then we also train people in green jobs to get more people skilled in solar and geothermal. So
fantastic.
It's exciting.
And your area is the Hudson Valley primarily.
The Hudson Valley, yes.
Well, that's great. Anna was with us for our special broadcast at Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliff a few weeks ago, and was fantastic. And the job was just in the
the next week, and I didn't want to jinx it.
But it's nice that you're. I'm so glad you're here and have the title, and congratulations on the new position. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, joins us. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Oh, good morning, Joe. Well, let me just say I've been listening to a lot of ABBA lately, so that gives you a sense of how my mood is. But on a serious note, if I could ask our listeners, this is serious. Apparently my 401k has run away and is missing. So if any of our listeners has seen my 401k, please tell it. I love it very much and miss it and wish it would come home to me.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that. Yeah.
And Dancing Queen. So that's why I'm listening to ABBA.
Finally, our second favorite Honan is with us today. Corporate attorney with Phillips Lytle LLP, Rich Honan. Is with us, and we couldn't be more thrilled. Recently, Rich's daughter, Emily, has been on the program, and what a wonderful addition to show. We are so happy to have her.
Thank you.
Not only is she brilliant, but she is just a ray of sunshine and so great on the air. So we're very happy, and it obviously she came by all of that quite honestly, and it's
from her mother.
No, it's wonderful to have her here. It's wonderful to have you here. I like the idea of a legacy.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's very nice.
Passing the torch.
Yeah. Well, good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. I did my 5 a.m. workout at Metabolic, and the trainer, for the third time, committed the cardinal sin of using my first and last name. So while she was yelling at me, she was like, Rich Honan. And then afterward, you have a lot of listeners, I guess.
Yes, we
at Metabolic. So where I was previously anonymous, I am no longer. I'm looking for a new gym if anybody has.
See, that's why I love my 5 a.m. class, because everybody calls me Kathy. I don't have to be called mayor, you know.
Right.
Like, you get to keep
it real.
Comes
till later. Yeah.
Be a little, you know. I'm just Kathy there.
Yes. Yes.
Well,
in all my 5 a.m. glory.
Also, let me just say, I have to apologize. I never formally introduced myself to Anna. I apologize. That was rude of me.
Well, it's nice. I always forget who has and has not
been on with each other.
But it's I'm glad you get to meet each other.
But there was such camaraderie when I walked in. I didn't want
it. It just felt natural. Yes, you know, yeah. Why disrupt the flow?
We're a fun group. All right. So we have I don't know. We have a lot to talk about this morning, as seems to be the way of the world here, and. The latest headline is that the trade war is escalating as China hits back again at the U.S. Beijing announces an 84% levy on U.S. goods. Markets are faltering. Of course, we'll know more at 9:30 when the Dow opens. China retaliated with more tariffs after President Trump imposed a 104% tariff on Chinese goods. Europe was poised to approve a plan to retaliate as well. Europe has been a little bit slow. We've been wondering what Europe has been up to, and now they are say that they are prepared. So this all intensifies as China announced the additional levies. This is just hours after the punishing new tariffs actually took effect. Stocks and bonds slumped on the move, which heightened fears of a global recession as the EU prepared its own retaliation for U.S. steel and aluminum tariffs. Mr. Trump's latest tariffs hit nearly all U.S. trading partners with new levies and raised import taxes on Chinese goods to 104%. Beijing then announced additional tariffs on imports from the United States for a total levy of 84% to go into effect within hours. We have been talking about the story since late last Wednesday, when the original announcement was made on quote unquote Liberation Day. And since then, things have been, quite frankly, all over the place. And we've been watching this. This from the let me just bring this up if I can get it, which is I wanted to get, there's a thing in the Wall Street Journal that I wanted to pick up.
While you're looking for that, Joe,
yes,
the European
please.
Union just announced that they are imposing up to a 25% levy on broad list of U.S. goods. So the war has expanded from China to the European Union.
So a lot going on, and we'll talk about this big banks reckoning with this, what's going on as well. Jamie Dimon saying that he believes a recession is likely, and China has ready to trade war arsenal that takes aim at U.S. companies. So all of this happening. And meanwhile, as of 1 minute ago, the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, says the economy is in good shape. All right. Rich, what do you think?
Oh, we're starting with me.
We're going to start with you.
I think it's as promised, probably a little more exciting than promised. I think that this tumult is going to go on. If it's still going on 2 quarters from now, that would be very bad. I would like to think that within a quarter, we will have reached deals with a good amount of nations. I don't know if the EU deals are going to be with the EU or bilateral deals with the member states. But Yeah, it's messy, and on, of course it's on top of the, you know, the whole idea of, you know, kind of slimming down the government. And one of the, you know, one of the things that we conservatives kind of like to skip over is we all decry government spending, but you got to remember it drives a really big part of our, what is it, 20% of 20% of the U.S. like GDP or something. And so while we do want to reduce government spending, and while we do want to get more free trade, freer trade, there's a cost. And right now we're seeing the cost.
I have two quick follow-up questions for you. One is, did we have to have tumult? Was tumult always going to be a part of the equation? Did it have to be that way?
Well, look, first of all, even Trump is everything Trump does is tumult, right?
Yeah,
so that's you know, but you know, I kind of assume that going in. And my answer is, yeah, I think if you're going to try and pursue disruptive policy, whether it's in trade, whether it's in social, whether it's in fiscal, I think it has to, it's got to be a little messy, because we've learned that incrementalism, and I'm not quoting Martin Luther King in his speech, but you know, the, what does he call it? The cooling elixir of incrementalism.
Yeah.
You know, that hasn't worked when it comes to making fiscal policy.
Final question before we move on to other members of the
I'm
group
leave
here.
After this,
which, no, you're not. As you have come to us for a very, very long time as a tech attorney. And helping tech startups, and I'm just curious, is that a sector? Is your job fundamentally changed by anything that is going on right now?
No, not at all. But to be fair, though, a lot of the companies at the startup level, you know, they're kind of beneath these waves. You know what I mean? I mean, they're looking for disruptive
right.
technologies. And really, the more world tumult there is, the more opportunities they see. But a startup, by definition, isn't usually, they're not importing goods yet or anything like that. Now, I assume if it turns into a real recession and employment gets difficult, then it might. But so far, no.
So there's nothing discouraging in what they're seeing.
Oh, I'm sure politically they might think so.
Sure.
But no, I think, I'll defer to the mayor on this, but I think we still see a lot of good startup activity coming out of our region between the colleges and kind of the supports the ecosystem.
Yeah, I think that the concern is that, and maybe investor dollars will be directed there more so because of the tumultuous situation on Wall Street. So that kind of remains to be seen. But I think that's the one concern: is where is the investment going to come from? You know, a lot of what we've been looking to do here in Albany, particularly with the work that Chuck Schumer did to get the national, lab here, is dependent on other countries coming and using this space as a place for really the world to develop the next generation of chips and the next generation of technology. So it'll be interesting to see what happens on the international level with respect to those expectations.
I agree. And let me just say one more thing. And the mayor brings up a good point. And I think what is going to hurt startup activity, not so much on the tariff side, but on the reduction of grant money, mm-hmm. something near and dear to everybody's heart, as well as my daughter's, right? But now that is a place between, you find a lot of startups between, the NIH grants and mm-hmm. DARPA and ARPA and all those. And I actually think that might have more of a chilling effect because so many of them, kind of get a little push from, some portion of a grant. And when those grants are held up, I think if that's where you're going
right.
with that, I very much agree.
And they start in our universities, and our universities are being hit. Some of the, really most prestigious research institutions and research universities are being hit. And so I think that is a real threat with respect to advancements in all types of technologies, not just tech, but the medical sector, pharmaceuticals, you name it. So
cyber.
I think we'll it remains to be seen what's going to happen there.
So can I ask Rich a question? Rich, as a conservative, do you support the tariffs then?
I support the use of tariffs as a policymaking technique. I don't support the use of tariffs from an economic standpoint necessarily, because I get who eventually pays. But, you know, if the goal here is reducing China's influence, and if the goal here is in decoupling, making it so China can't be the party along with India who's buying the energy from Russia that other people aren't buying, if that's the goal, then I do support using economic means rather than, I won't go as far as military, but by using other means. And I happen to think that's the eventual goal, is we're trying to change behavior by using economic leverage.
So to that extent, I support it. So the idea of the tariffs on Canada and EU and the penguins and everything else.
I think that I would agree. Again, if those tariffs, if we're still in the same position 3 months from now, a quarter from now, then I would agree with you. I think there's going to be some tumult. I'd like to think that once we start cutting deals, you know, Japan, South Korea, who was ever, you know, first on the list, maybe Great Britain, you know, not a member of the EU or England, then I'd like to think that things will start to calm down. But I think the, quote, trade war with China is a calculated thing. And I'd rather be fighting China with money than, you know, if they land in Taiwan.
Yeah, and I'd rather be fighting China with our allies rather than alone. And I think, you know, I'm worried, you know, there seems to be this feeling that all these deals are going to get cut. And I'm looking at the situation out there and I'm thinking, A, why would you trust this administration? I mean, he's made deals that he hasn't followed in the past. And also, where is the off-ramp on this war? I mean, who blinks first, and how do they do it without looking weak or without jeopardizing their own domestic authority? And that's what really worries me, is that I see things ramping up, and I see the rhetoric, and I see the insults that we're hurling even at our own allies. And if you're a leader of these other countries, how do you blink without the ire of your own people being levied against you?
By both sides blinking.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, both sides are going to have to blink.
I don't think that he's either. I think he's too arrogant and not smart enough to blink. I think that the other world leaders now are looking at a change in the fundamental relationship that we've enjoyed for many, many decades, and maybe they don't need to cut a deal with us because we're no longer something that can be trusted.
But the fundamental relationship for many decades, and I keep saying I'm going to stop, so I will stop.
No, you're fine.
The foundation of the relationship for too many years has been the United States paying for a lot of initiatives that either the EU or NATO, you know, pays lip service to, but we end up paying. And that's, to me, that's kind of an overriding policy. And I don't think that Trump was reticent about making that an issue. That's one of the things I voted for. And I think he blinks a lot more than you give him credit for. I think, in fact, during the first term, everybody, he was pilloried for being too transactional. You know, for, he would do this and then he would change his mind and do this. I think he's coachable and I think he wants to do a deal. I think he really, really, really wants to avoid military intervention at almost any cost.
I mean, Mayor. I think you're giving him a tremendous amount of credit, but I think this is classic Trump. I mean, this is what he does. This is how he does business. This shouldn't surprise anyone. I mean, for those who say, you know, oh, this is happening. I think he was emboldened by the stance that he took with NATO in 2017-18 in his first term. And I think that it did result in our allies doing more and that this status quo that you talk about, right, this is kind of the way things were. And, you know, the U.S. has probably always carried more than what Trump considers it to be our fair share, and maybe conservatives think to be our fair share. And so, you know, this is he wants to upset the status quo. He thinks that this is going to work. And, you know, that this is his style. And the unknown, right, is we don't know how it's going to play out. We don't know the impact that it's going to have. And he doesn't really seem to care.
No.
Right. So this is how he does business. It's why 7 of his businesses went bankrupt. And so we're watching in real time. And he's surrounded by some people who are telling him this is the dumbest idea in the world, and others who I don't think are coaching him, or you said he's coachable. I think they're just along for the ride, whatever he says goes, and they're just sycophants, and they're going to say, yes, sir. So I think this is him, this is his gut, and we'll see whether we end up with bankrupt casinos in Atlantic City or, you know, an economy that is stronger.
Adam?
I think I'm not surprised by the tactics. We all expected deal making. I'm surprised as to the tools that he's able to use to get this done. I personally didn't see him being able to declare national emergencies for every single topic that he finds, you know, inconvenient. The fact that he can say, oh, a trade deficit that's been going on since 1975 is a national emergency. What? You can take away Congress's ability to issue tariffs and be able to do that completely unilaterally because of just some statement that you made? Can you make that for any statement? Are we going to do this for daylight savings time because we don't like that? Like, what is the limit? It just seems crazy.
The other question I want to just real quick before we go to a break here is, when you have so many economists who are, you know, upset.
Very.
And saying it's silly and self-destructive and
yeah.
so forth.
I mean, the Wall Street Journal reads like the New York Times these days. Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to
yeah.
ask you.
CNBC.
I mean, so how do you feel about that? Meaning that what does that say about their expertise? It seems to me when you have that many professionals and who do this for a living, suddenly come forward and say, I have never seen anything as messed up as this, that you at least have to look at that and say, oh, that's a little concerning.
Sure. I think the sides are pretty clearly drawn. I mean, there's one side that believes that tariffs used in hopefully a non-permanent way or a trade war is a way of affecting social and societal change. And then there's the other one to say, but the cost is too high. And look, the Biden years were great for Wall Street Journal types and CNBC types. You know, if you're, you know, if you have a bunch of money and you have 7 figures and your biggest problem is, do I put it in the bank at 5% interest with zero risk, or do I, you know, take a shot at the stock market at 12%? You know, that's not a bad day. He's costing them the money. And of course they're going to get upset about that. I personally, I'm willing to live through it for a little while. I agree with you, Bob, on the 401k. I mean, I put mine in cash, and I voted for the guy. I put mine in cash, you know, since before he was elected, because you knew this was going to happen. And by the way, by doing so, I also missed out on the rocket rise of the Dow, you know, in the intervening months. But, you know, at my age, I can't afford to take too much risk.
Mayor, we got a letter from Kerry who says, I run a small business. We're unable to plan for the future because we don't see any stability ahead in our budget, and we're relatively small. How on earth can even a large corporation plan to establish big new factories in the U.S. if they don't even know what their financials will be next week? When it comes to, let's say, the city of Albany, but cities like Albany and cities across this country and municipalities across this country who are trying to deal with businesses, both large and small, what do they do at this exact moment?
Right now, we're seeing a lot hit the pause button. So whether it's proposals for new housing developments, whether it's looking at opportunities to invest in downtown, we have had a few buildings that have sold recently, with a view towards potential development. But I think, you know, it is incredibly hard, and that's the human toll on this. This is not something that is benign, right? And even if it's better in 3 months, there will be some that won't make it. There'll be some businesses that will just say we can't do this. And so, you know, it's been very hard for small businesses, not just in Albany, but, you know, really everywhere since the pandemic. Now, a number of them are dealing with having to repay loans at a much faster rate than what they expected because of a latest edict from this administration. And so I'm concerned that we're going to see more small businesses really struggle. We're looking to see what resources we might have to help our small businesses, but that's unfortunately for, you know, any municipality to have a significant impact is challenging. But I'm sure that our, you know, Empire State Development and the folks that are working on this at the state level are going to be taking a hard look at, is there a way that, you know, we could step in and create that payback timeline for those SBA loans that is what these businesses signed up to, and, you know, and help them pay them off at the rate that they're now being asked to by SBA.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll go to letters. We have one with a subject line, "What the hell is the matter with you all?" I may begin there. We'll look at that, and we'll take other letters as well. We'll be back in just a moment. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning, 9:41 on this ninth day of April, a Wednesday. Let's go to letters. John writes to us, just as Musk has permanently tarnished the Tesla brand with its customer base, so too has Trump now permanently tarnished the American brand with its overseas customers. Who really believes Canadians or Asians or Europeans will willingly buy American goods, even if tariffs are removed? Bob?
I think that's a really important letter. That our brand, our international brand, has something that has carried us. We have been a beacon of promise and hope for an awful long time. And I think the general feeling from the international community is that even given bad administrations, that there was a solid footing in this country that the rest of the world could trust. And, you know, I would push back on something, Rich, you said earlier about, you know, paying, you know, that we've been paying too much. A lot of our foreign policy that helped us was our soft power. It was USAID. It was the fact that we were actually siphoning off some of the best and brightest of the international minds to come to our universities, and frankly, they didn't leave. That's what happened in Silicon Valley. That's what happened in Research Triangle, and we have violently shut those spigots off, and I'm not sure it will ever turn back on. And if they do, they're not going to turn on the same way they did. So whether it was intentional or not, and I would argue that it is intentional because it's a way of fundamentally breaking bastions of quote liberal thought unquote. We are a greatly diminished country, and even if the economy turns around, which I do not believe it's going to, this country is not going to have the prestige or global leadership that it had.
And I think building on that, right, we know that people are going to die in countries that relied on USAID, and maybe other countries should have been contributing more, but the way that this administration has gone about the cuts that it's made and it's ripped out even the capability of being able to prevent what we know is going to happen with respect to the spread of disease and the access to vaccinations, access to preventing moms from passing AIDS on to their children. I mean, this is, and that's where the stature, I think, you know, whether it was fair or not, and we could have conversations around that, the way that we've gone about doing this, I think, is shocking to the world.
Well, it's not just the world, Kathy. I mean, it's our own country. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about it. We have a measles outbreak that is continuing to run rampant. And the best answer from our federal government to send RFK Jr. down there? I mean, come on. I mean, we're talking about staring at a budget that if Congress follows the guidelines that they have passed, there will be starving people in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I've asked our continuum of care for this area to tell me what we're going to see. And if people are concerned about public safety and community safety now, if these cuts go through, immediately there will be hundreds of people in Albany, Schenectady, and Rensselaer counties who need mental health support in order to be able to maintain. They will be cut off immediately, and within 90 days, you will have thousands of people who will lose their housing.
But I mean, and this is one of those things where I don't think there is any adult leadership or training or whatever the term was used earlier for Trump. We are seriously talking about a military parade on his birthday. I'm sorry, we're going to be talking about cutting back on health benefits to the poorest of the poor, to things like SNAP and food to children. And we're going to do a military. We're going to do a Soviet Union-style military parade on this guy's birthday. And I thank you for not pushing the button. and how is this conscionable? And again, where is the leadership? And frankly, right now, if any of our congressional leaders are listening, I'll tell you what, I would get rid of all of you. I don't care about the party. I would wipe out both the Senate and the House and bring fresh people in to see if we can get some leadership there right now, because there is none.
I agree with you on that one. I absolutely agree with you on that one.
Let's go to mental note. Bob doesn't like parades. Okay. Amy says...
We're clowns.
Rich, what are we negotiating? Trump has no consistent message on this. Is it the trade deficit? Is it fentanyl? Is it immigration? There is no reason for this that has been expressed. If China was the target, then target China with specific tariffs. We have become completely unreliable as trading partners, and also... with the mass deportations, how do you suppose factories will be built fast enough to take up the difference? This is just Trump being a bully. I'm sorry you voted for him. But the question stands, which I think is a good one. What are we negotiating?
I think all that. You know, we started with a tariff discussion with Mexico, and we ended up with 10,000 Mexican soldiers, you know, guarding, you know, that side of the border. I think fentanyl. I think it is the tariffs are being used to negotiate. And by the way, I think that's why so many of these negotiations need to be bilateral and not necessarily as a group. I think the tariffs are being used to negotiate changes in state behavior, countries' behavior that we have found to be inimical to our interests. And whether it's, you know, whether it's Mexico helping us with immigration, whether it's, you know, China refraining from doing, you know, I can name 16 different things, you know, or whether it's, you know, countries doing business with Russia. I think that's where, well, I don't think that that's what this is all aimed at.
I mean, I think that it's a tool for him to gain power. I think he's trying to negotiate one off so that people feel beholden to him, saying, oh, you gave me this gift that it would have cost me hundreds of millions of dollars if you did not give this to me. So therefore, I won't question your power or authority moving forward. And I think it's a tactic for that is dangerous for us to let happen. And I think that even if it's just China in the end, because I don't think China is going to bend over and say, oh, yes, Mr. Trump, we are wrong. I just don't see that happening. So we're going to have huge tariffs on Chinese goods. And even that alone could cause a recession. It's a huge amount of goods that will cost double, triple. Who knows what it'll escalate to?
But think about what happened last night, though. He spoke, the president spoke at the Republican congressional dinner last night. And what did he say? He came out loud and he said that he really likes the fact that people are coming to him, and this is his quote, Joe, kissing my ass. Okay?
Yes.
So I don't, you know, I've never bankrupted a casino, so maybe I'm not the best negotiator, but I know if I'm going to negotiate with people, the idea of actually embarrassing them before the negotiation starts, probably not the best way to approach it. But this is the arrogance that this is how the country is going to be perceived globally. And again, just by that simple statement, what and who is going to go hat in hand to him without looking like you completely caved?
We go to Robert, who says, regardless of whether Trump will win any concessions, why am I paying for his objectives? I contributed to my retirement investment account for decades before retiring, entirely due to Trump's self-inflicted trade war with the known world. The value of my investments have decreased more than the cost of my home. And that is from Robert, similar to what you were talking about earlier, Bob.
Well, wait a minute. I've been contributing to social causes that I am deeply opposed to by paying my taxes. And I've been doing that for, you know, as many years as I've been working. But that's part of it. That's, you know, you don't get to, you pay your taxes and the prevailing administration does what they want with the money. None of us like it. I didn't like it under the Biden administration or under Obama.
But Rich, I think to that point, though, we can disagree about policy. I have never questioned that the aim of an administration, even if I didn't agree with it, was to, in their view, do something that they thought was going to make us a stronger country and was going to help people, particularly working class folks. And that's been true of both parties, whether I've agreed with the tactics or not. I think what we are witnessing now is that we have a leader for whom I don't think it matters. This is about him. This is about his ego, his desire to have absolute power, his desire to be seen as, I don't know what, a dictator, the greatest dictator ever. But I don't, when I look at what is happening and what he is doing, there is nothing about it that seems to be grounded in a policy or in a philosophy around how to make working class folks in this country stronger, better, have more opportunity, feel safer, be able to care for themselves and get their kids a good education, because none of this gets you there. And so it is radically different than anything that I've seen in my lifetime or that I've studied in history.
I don't think that's true. I think that when I look at the Obama administrations and when I look at the Biden administration, I see administrations that in my mind and in the minds of others were hell-bent on this idea that America is a flawed country, it's a bad country, and it deserves comeuppance in the eyes of the world. And I know you... I know we're polar opposites on that, but and I know this is kind of a disconnect between conservatives and liberals. I know you don't believe this, but as strongly as you feel about what Trump is doing, we felt that strongly when Obama went on his apology tour. We felt that strongly when Obama and his administration blew the whistle on Israel trying to bomb the Iran nuclear facilities, and they outed them. We felt that strongly when they did the Iran deal. We felt that strongly under Biden with everything he did with COVID, when he basically gave our energy policy to Russia and allowed Russia to walk into Ukraine. So we felt as strongly as you feel about this, we felt just as strongly.
But it wasn't about them. It was about a vision of America that included everyone. And you might not like that. You might not like that in order to lift others up who have been sidelined, not at the table, not part of the conversation, in fact, harmed by things that our government did, that in order to ensure that we are truly a strong and united country, that we have to be willing to talk about those things. So we can disagree about that. But I never questioned that those individuals were acting to make America a stronger, better place for average working Americans, for those of us who are here, to be able to grow our economy, to be able to grow jobs, to be able to ensure that as we have an aging population, we're attracting people who are going to come here and continue to bring prosperity to our country. So that the difference to me is that this is not, and this is individual, does not appear to be acting in anyone's interest other than his own.
And all I'm saying is, as strongly as you feel about that, that's how I felt, more so about Biden than Obama, okay? I think Obama felt that he had a greater purpose of, again, you know, bringing America, you know, giving its comeuppance. But I think Biden very clearly was the guy who had been kicked around for 40 years. Everybody made fun of him. He was always stupid. The military never listened to him. And he decided, I'm going to go in, and in whatever lucid moments he had, I'm going to go and I'm going to override what my people say. We're going to do this in Afghanistan. We're going to do this in Ukraine. I hear what you're saying. I understand. We feel as strongly as you do, is what I'm saying.
But I think that he stayed within the constitutional bounds of what power allowed. I think that he used Congress appropriately. He didn't circumvent their
who are we talking, Biden?
Biden and Obama. I think that people didn't realize that just, you know, breaking constitutional law was an option. With Obama, we negotiated a lot on health insurance, and ended up with the Obamacare that we have today. I think that if we weren't negotiating with Republicans, we would have had a very different outcome for that. I think the same thing with Biden. I think that under today's circumstances, Trump is breaking laws and seeing if it works. And I don't think that that's something that's ever happened before. And I just don't think it's something that we should allow.
Obama was the architect of I have a pen and I have a phone. Obama and Harry Reid were the architect of the nation acting extra legislatively. That's not a good word, but taking actions without congressional action. Right, the executive orders, the regulatory agencies.
I'm sorry, Rich, but I don't think any of that compares to what we are dealing with now. And a number of those actions were overturned by the courts. I'm not suggesting that I agreed with every decision that was made by every Democratic president, but they acted within an understanding of the presidency, that it was part of a broader constitutional framework.
No, they didn't. They did that, and that's our.
Well,
when Barack Obama says, "I can't change the immigration laws," that would be unconstitutional. I can't do that without Congress. And then he goes and changes his actions. And Biden does the same thing.
Meanwhile, we have declared a national emergency and started
deporting people
with no due process to El Salvadorian jail. So, you know, I don't think that
it also ignores the fact that Obama deported more people than.
No, that's such an old trite thing. He
did.
Oh,
wait
deport
a second.
More.
If we're going to talk about old trite things, some of the stuff that you've been saying is just crazy.
Let's not go there, Rich. No, that whole thing. The Obama administration. Where was? Oh, he was the
idea of blaming Biden for Ukraine. I mean, come on, for the Russia attacking Ukraine. Yeah. Come on, give me a break, man.
Did that happen under Trump?
It didn't happen under Trump. No,
it happened under Obama and Biden.
Oh, so you're going to blame Biden for that?
Absolutely. Are you, Bob? Are you kidding? Biden on
no,
the first
I'm
day
not.
On the okay. First of all, for Obama did not. They changed the definition of deportation under Obama. That's a known thing. It used to be deportation meant you came in, you got into the country, and then you were sent out. That was deportation. Am I wrong on this?
No.
Under the Obama administration, people who were turned back at the border were considered deported. So now suddenly that number it became much bigger. So they changed that definition. And Joe Biden, more than anybody else, well, that's not true, besides Vladimir Putin, obviously, Joe Biden gave such a runway for that war when he took our energy policy and said, we're not going to do this. We're going to give this and we're going to let Russia the amount of revenue that he moved to Russia to be able to sell energy for the first 18 months or whatever until they moved in. Energy is a weapon these days. We don't like it, but it is. And he unilaterally disarmed. Russia made so much money doing that. And then when Russia massed 70,000 people on the Ukrainian border, he did nothing. And NATO did nothing. And all they did was crow about, hey, we're all on the same page. But we're all on the same page of doing nothing.
And you know, Rich, you know what green-lighted Putin to go into Ukraine? It was Donald Trump. And it was when he undermined the NATO alliance and he underlined our intelligence community and he cozied up to Putin and he began that chain. That was the green light. And let me ask you this question. What did you want Biden to do? Did you want him to send soldiers, American soldiers, into fight in Ukraine?
No, but I would have. Then what
would you want him to do?
I would have wanted him to do what he ended up doing. But I would have done it before they got there, when he started sending, when we finally did decide to send lethal weapons over, when we finally did start to get NATO together, which we waited until after Russia had moved in, making it so much harder. I would have liked them to have set up their defenses before while people were still massing on the border, and because they ended up doing it anyway.
While Putin was threatening a nuclear option,
Putin's always going to threaten a nuclear option.
None of us were in the room, but to suggest that a president now who has said that Ukraine started this war is somehow not making this situation and democracy and democracies across the world shudder, I think it's comparing. There is no comparison.
Well, how does this war end? Tell me how this war ends.
What war are we talking about?
Between the conservatives and the liberals? I don't know.
Oh no.
That one never ends. That's a real problem. Yeah. I don't know how.
The best way this war will end is I got to go to a news break.
Okay, there we go.
Okay.
By the way, this is just a skirmish.
I
learn a lot every time I'm here. I respect all these opinions. I know I don't agree with them, but it doesn't mean I don't respect them or their intelligence or their points of view.
Why we love having you on. We'll take just a break saying, and we'll no, be out right after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this ninth day of April. It is 8 minutes past 10 o'clock on this Wednesday morning. Let me reintroduce the panel to you. Robert Griffin is here, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Corporate attorney with Phillips Lytle LLP, Rich Honan. It joins us. Anna Markowitz, Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead, is here. And Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan joins us as well. A couple of letters, and then we'll start to move on to other aspects of conversation. Stephanie writes, kudos. Today's sparring is what I need to hear. It's important to hear opposing views delivered by intelligent people who are willing to listen to each other. Then there is, I think, one of the nicest letters we've gotten, which is, if Trump respected other people's opinions like Rich Honan did, we would have a very different Trump one we could stomach. That's from
high praise.
That's from James. Very nice. Very nice. Thank note you.
Thank
there.
You.
You'll be sending him $10. Okay.
In view of the discussion I'm now listening to, says Aline, I believe, I fear that we are even more divided than we thought. I find it incredible that Mr. Honan can defend Trump and his policies, if only on the level of how they affect and will affect our country. But that's it, right? I mean, we are divided.
Yeah, no, this is actually more, I think, a reflection of where we are as a country. And I think we'd be remiss if we didn't have at least a little conversation on how do we put Humpty Dumpty back together again? Because the differences are so stark right now.
Well, you're not going to find an egg.
No, it's like, I couldn't afford one if I did.
Right.
But I do think that, you know, what commonality do we have? And, you know, I'll speak personally, Joe. I find even my sense of a national identity question, my sense of empathy. You know, I really do feel like there's a lot of people that have forced us to put the hand on the hot stove, and they're like, you know, I'm like, okay, they need to get burned, which is really bad because that's not good for the country.
All right, let's move on to.
And I'm apparently the only one on the panels that's immature and stamping their feet. So okay.
No, I agree. I would like to think that one of the ways we put things back together is by having conversations like this, and you know, which get spirited yet civil, I guess.
No, I agree.
I think that's part of it. But the other part of it, you know, it's funny. We were talking earlier about, you know, going to the gym early in the morning, you know, and, you know, I stop at Stewart's at 4:45 and get coffee before that's my energy drink. And, you know, 4:45 in the middle of winter in Albany, you walk into Stewart's and somebody walks out and they hold the door for you. You hold the door for them. People say good morning. People are, I probably don't agree with everybody there. Right. But I think that's kind of where it starts. You know, people do get along with each other fairly fundamentally. And the fact that we're arguing about, say, tariffs, for example, I'd say that's a small percentage of what we deal with in our everyday life. And I think in our everyday life, people get along better than we give ourselves credit for.
I want to go to a couple of other topics real quick. And I'm just curious, we don't have to spend a lot of time on this, but in the fight of Musk versus Navarro, where what's the money line on this? Anyone want?
It's a win-win for me. I mean, I mean, this is like I got my.
I mean, if we have to live through this, we might as well have a little bit of entertainment. Yeah. I really liked the apology to the BRICS, but
I just wanted to correct that. That's not BRIC.
Mr. Trump has not weighed in on the spat between his top aides, both of them, who he holds in high order, and so it is interesting to see these two men really have a rift over trade. Elon Musk
was that really it, or was it? I thought what really set him off, what set off Musk was when he said, you don't make cars, you assemble cars.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that was a return, though.
I think that came back.
I think it is about tariffs.
Okay. All right. But I think that's what took it into like a personal
and correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, Musk came out and was actually advocating, I felt, that no tariffs on the EU, that the idea that we create a free trade zone so there's no tariffs at all. And started to question, and I think Navarro took that as an attack on tariffs, and then we started to see the really enjoyable middle school exchange of taunts.
Yeah, I think Rich, you're partially right here. So Musk, who lost roughly $31 billion since Mr. Trump announced the tariffs on April 2nd. Spoke out and said that he believed that there were other ways to address this. The squabble then escalated on Monday when Mr. Navarro said on CNBC that Mr. Musk was not a car manufacturer but a car assembler because Tesla, Mr. Musk's electric vehicle company, relied on parts from around the world. Mr. Wow. Musk fired back on Tuesday, calling Mr. Navarro a moron and dumber than a sack of bricks. That in a post on X, a social media site that he owns. Later in the day, Mr. Musk doubled down, posting that he wanted to apologize to the BRICS. That was so unfair to BRICS, he wrote. He also used a slur to refer to Mr. Navarro, calling him that I don't want to mention here on the program. But anyway. So, meanwhile, Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary, tried to downplay the feud and said, boys will be boys.
Billionaires will be billionaires. Yeah.
They will let their public sparring continue and we will watch. All right.
I don't often agree with Musk these days, but I think that the tariff situation's not going to go well, and Navarro might not be the champion that he was on day one. So I don't know. That's my only pro-Musk statement of the year.
And it's only April. So
yeah. I'm committing. I'm committing to eight more months of no positive statements.
You used them up.
Just one.
We're done on that. All right. The IRS chief has quit. And I find this to be an interesting story. The IRS chief quit over a deal to share data with immigration authorities. Melanie Krause clashed with Treasury Department officials who sought to circumvent IRS executives so that immigration authorities could access taxpayers' information. The acting head of the IRS said that they're going to resign after being bypassed over a new agreement to share the tax data of undocumented immigrants with Homeland Security personnel. Acting IRS Commissioner Melanie Krause, the tax agency's third leader since President Trump's inauguration, will participate in the deferred resignation program the Trump administration offered to agency employees in recent days. And disagreements over the agency's direction also factored into Krause's decision to leave, according to the people. Losing three agency leaders in 3 months is unprecedented. One of the people said, "I don't think we've seen anything like this, certainly not at the IRS."
And, you know, this is, I think, a microcosm of what really scares me is that the brain drain from the federal workforce, that whether you agree with all of the policies or not, let's just say one thing about the federal workforce, that there are some incredibly talented people who care deeply about the country, who are specialists in areas that there are very few specialists, and we are driving people away, and we're losing institutional knowledge, and we're certainly losing an understanding of sort of norms, rules, regulations, and laws. You know, part of the mythos that has been created about about immigration and illegal immigration that gets missed is, they pay taxes, and they actually pay quite a bit of taxes. And part of the understanding is that different governmental systems would be kept separate on purpose. Not that the government is inefficient. It's actually the idea that the government shouldn't be putting our data together in ways that gives the federal agencies too clean or too easy a view into who we all are as people. Because if you all think that this is just going to end with immigrants, mm-hmm. it's not. Okay. And it's really, I will also note something that Levitt just, was talking about with Trump looking for ways to deport U.S. citizens. So you start to see this, an administration that has been unapologetic about retribution, and now what we're doing is that we're compiling more and more of our own personal information and combinations of personal information that are in different databases in ways that, frankly, we're not only building Skynet, but we're building giving all of the seeds to a governmental infrastructure that it was never meant to. And Congress isn't standing up for us. All right, Congress has put safety rails in place that the administration has blown through. You know, so you think about what's being done with the IGs and all of the watchdogs, and this is going to cost all of us.
I always wondered that. I'd like to know the answer to that, of the idea that at some point it became the policy. I guess that's my question. Is it a law? Is it a policy? It is a regulation. At some point, somebody said, all right, we have people who are in the country, not fully legally, they are working, we'd like to tax them. Okay, yeah. Fine. And then the decision was made, but we're not going to share that tax information with, I guess, what was then INS.
I think it's that we don't share tax information, period. And so, you know, it's similar to the rules around the census, that that information, when you fill that out, the promise is made to you that this won't be used for any other purpose.
Right.
And so, you know, it's similar to when people, you know, give me a hard time and there's no legal definition of sanctuary city. But when we talk about the city of Albany, it's that we want to encourage people to do the right thing. And we don't want them to be fearful about doing the right thing because they think that we're going to use their legal status against them. So if you are here and you're undocumented and you are mugged or you have a domestic violence situation, we want you to report that, knowing that our police department is not does not enforce immigration laws. And so we're not going to ask you about that. If you have a dog and you need a dog license, we want you to come and get a dog
right.
license.
Or if you're a witness to a crime.
Right. And yeah. So I think that we want you to comply. And I think that's where, and I don't know the answer as to whether it was rulemaking or if
right.
it's a regulation. I think that's an important question. But I think that this is what's not happening in the speed and the ferocity with which this administration is acting. That we're not stepping back and asking the question of why do we do that? And every elected official, one of the things you learn in mayor school is that that's a really good question to ask. As you're learning about your city and the different departments and what happens, asking the question, why do we do that, sometimes leads to an answer where, well, gosh, you know, I have a police chief that says he asked the question, why do we have a patrol person sitting on the corner of Main and Central Avenue every Sunday? Well, it's because 20 years ago, there was an alderman whose mom walked to church that way. Mm. And so they put somebody on the corner, right? So sometimes you ask, why do we do that? And the answer that you get is, we don't need to do that anymore. But sometimes the answer is a really good answer. And that's
agree.
What we're not having and discussing in the ferocity yeah. and the utter carelessness, in my from my view, of what is happening with DOGE and with all of the upheaval that we're seeing in our federal government.
But Rich, I'll answer it slightly differently. I also think that it's a combination of there are laws, there are administrative rules, but most importantly, this is another example in my mind of something where the technology didn't exist when laws were passed. And Congress has not kept up with their responsibility and instead turned too much of the responsibility over to the agencies. Rather than passing laws saying, here's what we're going to do to protect our personal identifiable information, what they've done is that they have kicked the can down the road. You know, I start to think about how far behind we are with our laws dealing with new technologies. So the idea that you could bring in, it, you know, supercomputing systems with AI capabilities that can now crunch all of this data was something that wasn't envisioned when we were programming in COBOL.
Right.
Okay.
And Fortran.
And right.
Yeah.
And now though, what we're getting to is that this is a loophole that's being taken advantage of. And once all of this data is put together and it's mixed in the ways that DOGE is mixing it, it's not going to be able to be unmixed.
And it's my understanding that it's not even a loophole, that this is actually in violation of identity privacy laws.
Which is part of why the IRS chief is quitting.
Is resigning. And I mean, I think that the big picture is that this is 7 million people and who are now at risk of being deported, who are now probably not going to be complying with tax law in the future. That's a whole lot of lost revenue. That's a whole lot of people who are now afraid, as the mayor said, to interact with our systems in other ways, because ways that had been safe now no longer are. And it's hard to minimize the impact of that.
Yeah,
we'll
the I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mayor.
No, go ahead.
The way you just explained sanctuary cities is the way I always understood it, and what made a ton of sense to me. You know, you didn't want people, you know, having to run from the police or being afraid to ask the police or ask any official for help, right? And I won't go into the whole thing, but you obviously know that. You know, a big part of the conservative ethos is this idea that to take that idea and then move it into, okay, but when we have a detainer, you know, on somebody, or, you know, if ICE has a detainer on somebody, the local police force is not going to honor that to us. That goes to your question, why are we doing it?
And I think that it is an important discussion, because I think most conservatives would actually ultimately agree with the position that we take, which is that we don't get paid to enforce civil immigration law. If there is a judicial warrant from ICE, we honor it.
Right.
We will not defy a judicial order.
But we are not. Right?
I've heard that there are some that are pushing back, but I don't. That is really not what people are talking about. I know Denver's taken a pretty hard stance with respect to cooperation. But look, I think that what we're talking about is that the federal government is responsible for enforcing what is mostly civil immigration law. These are civil. We just like we don't enforce tax law. We're not going to hold someone who the IRS may have an issue with.
Right.
Simply because the IRS has a civil case against that individual. And so when we talk about immigration status, and even when we talk about undocumented, we're not necessarily talking about deportable people. We are talking about people who are in a process in this country around their immigration status. And so it is incredibly complicated. And we have to put together, when we work with this population, and the city doesn't work with them, but we have the immigration clinic at Albany Law School and a lot of NGOs that work with our migrant community. And you should see how complicated it can be, because even within a family, you can have people that have different status. Some might be allowed to work. Some might not be allowed to work. Some might be. It is incredibly complicated. And so the demonization and this, you know, pitchforks and, you know, torches sort of mantra of like, let's get these people out of here. To me, it's going to hurt our economy, and it is hurting our economy. And secondly, it's not reflective of what the true legal situation is. And yes, it's complicated, and that's frustrating for people, but the Republicans had an opportunity to fix it, and they didn't take it. The Democrats had an opportunity to fix it, and they didn't take it. And so this is where we are.
Yeah, but
I'll give you time to think about it. Just a couple of letters, and then we'll get to a break, and then maybe we can come back to where we were. Jim writes, good morning, panel. Just to say that the discussion this morning is great. Also, thanks to Dag, who says, in that we can all get along at the door in the line at Stewart's unless we're having a really bad day. You know, you've seen that person. Maybe you've been that person. We're mostly having worse and worse days. I would just like to point that out. Great debate today, and much like what's going on in our country, please in the future bring both sides to the panel. These debates were missing in the run-up to the election, and now we're paying the price. Trump is president now. Whatever Biden, Obama, Nixon, FDR, Teddy Roosevelt, Hoover, Jefferson, did in the past is irrelevant to what President Trump is doing now. Gabby says, yes, it's great to have conversations with people you don't agree with, but the bigger problem is to be unwilling to actually change your opinion and position. I'm so grateful for Rich being available today like this, not because I share his views, but because having him on gets the other panelists to use the blunt language needed to reach more listeners. These uncomfortable discussions need to be broadcast for the public more frequently. Thank God for Rich Honan, a much more interesting discussion, and I agree with Rich's assessment of things and his ability to back up his viewpoint with accurate information. That from Trish. We go to Wendy. Having someone on the show who is pro-Trump flies in the face of humanity, and to be honest, it's just dangerous. Dear Joe, I actually disagree with Rich on a significant number of issues, but his presence on the panel has, in my opinion, elevated the conversation from an echo chamber of people who almost always agree most days. This thoughtful conversation between intelligent, well-meaning people is what we need far more of.
I think Mark Whitman I'll never say it as well as Mark Whitman did, but he said, Rich, you know, I love when you're on because when you disagree, that's how I know that I'm right.
but it's also important to remember, Joe.
Wait, we got to take a quick break, and then you can come back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Bob Griffin, Rich Honan, Anna Markowitz, and Kathy Sheehan with us this morning. We welcome you. I just want to go through a few more letters because I promised that we would have much more, and I want to make good on that promise, and then we'll go to two other topics before we call it a morning panel-wise. Let's see. We go to Thomas, who says, in general, please know that not everyone thinks like 95% of the panelists who appear on the roundtable. There are a lot of people who think like Rich Honan and who have realistic perspectives on the economy and politics and who don't see death, doom, and destruction in every single move that the current president makes, specifically with regard to the tariffs. Go Rich. Then we go to Anne. Rich, do you not care about us with limited income watching our 401ks decline? We are scared. We are hurting. Do you care?
I say you care. I do care. I care deeply about that. I think that in the longer run, not the very long run, but in the longer run, your 401k is going to be fine, and we will have a firmer financial foundation. Sorry for the alliteration. For you to do better in the future.
Serious question from David, who says...
Sounds like you're quoting Smoot Hawley.
This from David. Rich, Burkean conservatism is based on a principle of building on what exists rather than tearing down. I see nothing conservative about our current president. Please comment.
Yeah, I can see that. I think a lot of, that's why a lot of the Republicans have problems with him. He's certainly not, in many ways, he's not a traditional conservative. I think where he is, what I think of as a traditional conservative is, and by the way, it's the whole smaller government. And I think that's, the big divide, I think the true personality aside, left versus right, is the extent to which you believe the government can be a source of, of solutions. Right. Mm-hmm. Or in some ways, a source of continuing problems. I think in that way, Trump is traditional in that he's looking for less governmental intervention. I'd like to think that where he morphs into is more effective governmental intervention. I think that's where we'd like to try to, whether it's him or somebody else, that's where we'd like to come out on this. I don't want anybody's Social Security to get cut, but I can't help thinking that we should be able to deliver those checks in a more cost-efficient way. I have no basis for saying that. But I believe that should be the case.
And I think there's a reverse to it too, though, where there's a disagreement is that I have said on the show that I don't trust government. I mistrust business more than I mistrust government. And that's something that we really don't talk a lot about. And, we've spent a little bit of time today talking about the concern about data in the government's hand being misused. I am equally, if not more, concerned about the amount of my personal data that is being controlled by corporations, many of whom are the oligarchs that were sitting right behind him in an inauguration day, there are no control over them. And what I want is that there are government functions that will at least try to keep the corporate interests in line.
I agree with that. I mean,
but you can't fire all of the
right. And I think that's where I think we're seeing this arrogance, this complete and utter arrogance of the oligarchs to come in and say, we're just going to fire tens of thousands of people and somehow this is all going to be more efficient. And I find that to be, first of all, that's not what's going to happen. We have people who are getting kicked off of Social Security because they can't get through on phone lines. We have, and we just have to continue to tell story after story after story of real people who are being harmed, who don't have a 401k, who don't have a rainy day fund, who don't have squirreled away 3 months, 6 months, of salary to get them through a bridge. And those are the folks that are being harmed by what is just complete arrogance. You know, when I became mayor of the city of Albany, and this is a much smaller scale, we paid everyone on a paper timesheet. Rich, I knew that wasn't effective, but I didn't throw out 10% of the workforce just for the hell of it to see what happened. We worked together. We found the money to invest in the technology that we needed, and we've been able to be more effective and efficient. You know, these are the ways that you go about achieving that, and how we're doing it. I think the thing that that writer is talking about is real people are being harmed by the approach that this administration has taken.
That's a great point. Just a few more letters, and then we'll move on. Rich is the best. Stop jumping on him. Scott says,
"All right, that was we get the Rich fan club is out there today. I can't.
Don't worry, there's plenty of countervailing.
I can't do it, guys. I turn on the show for honesty and clarity. Rich is delusional. Clay,
there you go.
Mayor Sheehan should primary Hochul. Kumbaya. No,
that would be good. You should do that.
Oh, look,
I'd
you know,
to
I
that.
Think that women elected officials, and I'm not, I'm not running for anything again, so I can say this, but you know, we could have a whole show about the challenges that people face and the standards that we're held to, and I think that Governor Hochul is one of those individuals who is held to a standard. I look at it. I look at predecessors. I look at elected officials across the country, and I'm like, what the hell? You know, she's. I think she's working incredibly hard. I look at the policies that she's trying to get pushed through in this budget, and I want to see them happen. I want to see us be able to strengthen our mental health laws. I want us to be able to ensure that, you know, working families get a tax break. I do want to see less regulation in New York State. Mm-hmm. I agree with that, but I think that there are smart ways to go about that. And so, you know, that's what we're seeing now, and that's leadership. That's real leadership.
I really like the, and I know it's not popular, but I really like the no cell phones in schools. I think
again,
that's
from
every standpoint.
And it's, you know,
it's almost a no-brainer.
And I will say her leadership style, right, unlike the current one, is to listen. You know, Governor Hochul sat down and talked to beat officers from the Albany Police Department, excused the press from the room, right? It wasn't, you know, this wasn't a camera moment. This was talk to me about what you're seeing and what would help. Yeah, you know, that's leadership.
All right. Let's see. Lee writes, oh, boy. Kumbaya. I guess I missed it, but it sounds like accolades are coming in for a civil debate as if we're all good and can all just move past the past. That's a nice proposition. But right now, I do not overlook that Rich Honan voted for and is a proud supporter of a man that was copacetic with his own vice president being hung by an angry mob that he sent to Capitol Hill. Then we go to Barry, who says, it is nice/convenient to blame the president, Congress, governor, and other politicians. The fact is the blame falls entirely upon our own shoulders. We are the ones who put them there in the first place.
Did we, though? I mean, yeah, I did. What choices?
I think that's positive for you, Rich. I think
I'm like, no, we didn't, but I think you did.
No, you actually did.
Yeah, no, you won
I
the
absolutely
election.
Did. Yes.
You know? Okay.
Yeah.
There you
although,
go.
Although I'm in New York State, so my vote didn't actually count. But you know, I hear that all the time. You get the government you deserve. Okay, but tell me when I show up at the when I have a choice between two people. Neither of whom I would vote. I'm not talking, forget president at the moment, okay? You know, two people, neither of whom I would vote for, right? Because they each are a fairly extreme wing of their particular party, and I'm looking for somebody, you know, like Mayor Sheehan, then how is that my fault? You know, I showed up to do my part. You know what I mean? Somebody else didn't do their job in presenting me with these choices.
Well, I think that
Oh, democracy.
It's right. That's democracy. Yeah. But I also think people can get involved at a hyper-local level. And we need to do a better job of teaching civics. We need for people, you know, I have people call my office all the time and they want me to help get, you know, their a judge in Brooklyn to look at their, you know, their case again because they're paying too much in child support. It's like, okay, this is the mayor of Albany.
Right.
So even just getting people to understand and get people to understand, like it starts at the local level. So who you elect to the common council matters because somebody on that council, and they did, is going to run for assembly.
Right.
And then that person might run, right? So I think if we're stronger at the local level, you get better choices as you go up. But right now we just have people who are influencers and they're worried about, you know, the number of likes they get on TikTok. Right. And that's who's in Washington in far too many numbers right now.
Final comments and a wrap up after this short break. We'll return to the roundtable in WAMC. Little whistling there, a little soupçon. Like that. Very nice. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Finishing up this morning with a great group. Bob Griffin, Rich Honan, Anna Markowitz, and Kathy Sheehan. So the Trump administration freezing $1 billion for Cornell and $790 million for Northwestern, according to officials. The funding pause amid civil rights investigations into both universities sharply escalates the Trump administration's campaign against elite colleges. The Trump administration has frozen the money. The funding pause involves mostly grants from and contracts with the Departments of Agriculture, Defense, Education, and Health and Human Services, according to the officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity. The moves are the latest and largest in a rapidly escalating campaign against elite American institutions that has resulted in billions in federal funds being suspended or put under review in just over a month.
What is the behavior they're aimed at?
Amid civil rights investigations is what the catch or the subject line is. You mean,
is it the anti-Semitism or is it something else?
So they've been using the anti-Semitism as sort of their stalking horse. In reality, I think it has very little to do with anti-Semitism and much more to do with the desire to curb the voices coming out of the college campuses. This really is predicated on the idea of we're going to punish the higher education. We're going to diminish their role in society, and we're going to do it in order to keep them down because this is most likely where protests are going to start. You know, a couple things, Joe. This is really dangerous to the country because the R&D, the research and development that's being done in the universities and colleges is, in my mind, is equally important to what's being done in industry. And there was a time in our history, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, where primary research, R&D, was being done through the federal government. We moved away from that model. And what we did is that we said, okay, rather than building all sorts of numerous national laboratories, we're going to try to bring this ecosystem of development to the colleges and universities and industry, and it's worked. But the grant funding is the backbone of an awful lot of the successes that we've seen and important changes that we've seen in society. And once you kill that ecosystem, okay, you know, once you start to close down these labs, and it does not come back quickly.
And I think that's where, like, that talking about slowing things down, you know, why do we do it? What is the cost benefit? And so we may quibble over the administrative fee that can be charged, but when you unpack it and you understand what it is, why it is what it is, then we can have a conversation. Is that the right number? Is that too expensive? What do we get for that from the standpoint of diseases that are cured and other technology that gets developed. That's all an important, I think, analysis and conversation to have happen. And I also think that with respect to these schools and universities, to me, any university that sent an email, and there were some, to Jewish students during the heights of those protests saying, we can't keep you safe, you should go home and finish the semester online, they need to have a plan so that that never happens again. Because if that had happened to any other protected class of people, there would be outrage. So I believe that that is something that these universities and colleges need to address and ensure that they can keep their student bodies safe. And I think that everything else is about what you just talked about. This is about you know, and this is where you get into the draconian piece of this and the when people use the F word of fascism. Sorry, I was not going to swear online.
No,
don't worry, Joe.
I know.
But when you start to curtail academic freedom, when you start to muzzle law firms, when you use powers that have not been used to deport immigrants, when you deport legal immigrants for First Amendment violations, now we're marching down a path that I think people are rightfully very concerned
about.
But
there's a difference in my mind, though, between anti-Semitism and the idea of questioning the policy, a policy. Okay, so the idea of I don't think that questioning how the state of Israel has carried out a conflict is by its nature anti-Semitism. I think part of the conversation we should be having is, you're right, I'm not going to stand up for anti-Semitism. I'm not going to stand up for any institution that would not protect their own students. But at the same time, I worry that impinging upon the freedom of expression, which now then goes into, because, okay, if you start to protest over how Israel is handling Gaza, is that anti-Semitism or not? And where does that line end?
Yeah, I don't think anybody draws that. I agree with the mayor. I don't think anybody draws that. We seem to be able to draw that line for when we're talking about anti-Semitism, that, oh, it's not really anti-Semitism, it's just anti-Israel. And I agree that one is not necessarily the other. But, you know, I kind of, and I freely admit I'm not objective about this, I kind of stop listening. Once you've admitted the anti-Semitism, you know, there's a prayer during Passover where they say, Dayenu, that would have been enough, you know, that's enough, whether it's a stalking horse or not. I think the anti-Semitism that has been allowed to proliferate on college, largely on college campuses, and I'm sorry, but I think it's permeated some big sections of the left wing of the Democratic Party. I'm very thankful that somebody's calling that out, because I agree with the mayor that had this been any other group, this wouldn't have even come to this.
Anna?
I encourage everybody to listen to the Daily podcast from today, which had the Princeton president on. I mean, we're talking about like 20% of some university's annual budget that's being held hostage. And a lot of university presidents are being forced with a terrible decision of, do we stop researching public health? Do we defund our medical schools? Like, these are really terrible outcomes that are being kind of held hostage, not with anti-Semitism as sort of a scapegoat, but what they're trying to do is they're trying to change the admissions processes. They're mm-hmm. trying to get rid of, programs that they don't agree with on diversity or, things that aren't in line with the Trump policies. And I think that that's an overreach, and we can't let the government tell private universities what they can teach and not teach.
No, we can't. But we can tell them what we will give them government money for. And if you want to be private, use your $54 billion endowment and stay private. And I understand that a lot of those funds are restricted and you can't just necessarily reach into it. But no, I think, and again, I freely admit I'm not terribly objective on this, but in too many places, these universities have become hate factories. And I have no problem with the federal government saying until you guys get your act together in some minimal way, we're going to hold up on your
But funds. I agree with what you're saying, is that that's not where the litmus test is. It's not just about anti-Semitism. They are telling these schools, we're going to look at your women's studies program. We're going to look at your African studies programs. We're going to tell you what you can and cannot teach. And this money that is coming to them isn't directed at those programs. And so you really are. Yes, I agree. When you hold the purse strings, you can decide from a policy standpoint what this funding can be used for. And so I understand that. But this is funding that was already approved, earmarked, ready to go. If this administration wants to shut off the valve, they can shut off the valve. But this is about funding that was already approved and supposed to be distributed. So I agree these schools need to be very clear about what is anti-Semitism and be – I mean, you know, it was an abomination, a lot of the things that we saw that happened on these campuses last year. And we still have to stand for the ability of these universities to go through with research that's already in the pipeline. And these are people that are going to be affected. These are grad students. These are, these are labs. These are ongoing studies. This will have, again, I think, a recessive impact and push us towards recession.
I'm glad you brought up the Daily, because the Princeton president is ready to fight.
Yeah, which I love.
Ready to fight. And this is counter to, say, Columbia, where they did not. And so I think we'll see these different approaches and where it gets them.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be fascinating.
Well, Princeton had less on the line. They said they had about $250 million versus Columbia's 400,000, and Columbia has a medical school that they, so every university is different. I think Columbia should have at least publicly said that they didn't want to compromise. But, here we are.
All right. You all are wonderful. Anna Markowitz, Bob Griffin, Mayor Sheehan, and Rich Honan, thank you so much for being with us and for a vibrant conversation. I appreciate it greatly. We'll be back right after this.